Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the 242nd episode of the Macko and Cause podcast. Why did I say the number? I don't know. It just seems like a pretty random number. I'm Matt. That's Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Matthew. I think that's a good number. Have we really done that many? Ooh, good for
242.
Us. 242. Yeah. We have a longer shelf life than my fridge, which just broke.
Oh, no. Like right now? Right now?
No, no. Last night. So last night, you know what dinner we had? Everything. We had the everything dinner. As a friend of mine said, it's like a sitcom where you have to eat everything that's in the fridge before it goes bad. So,
oh, yeah.
What, you know what I had for dinner last night, Matt? Chicken shrimp sauce.
Ice cream.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I did the shrimp jerk style, made two bags of it. You know, you don't think about this stuff. In the last 2 years, we've lost our dishwasher, our sink fell out, the stove broke, and now the fridge is broken. And it's because we moved into our home about 20 years ago and got all new stuff. So it's like, I mean, obviously there's planned obsolescence, but it's really interesting to see how well coordinated it's been. Within about 2 years, everything we have broke.
Ugh, I fear that day because that's going to be coming to me soon. Like our dishwasher broke a couple of years ago and we just wash now in the sink. But the other day, actually, it's interesting you bring this up. Our stove, when we try to turn the temperature up, it sticks, so it just goes up and up until like 500 degrees, and we're like, "Oh no, you know, we're cooking hell over here."
So if you're just trying to make some bruschetta, it comes out like briquettes.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going down there as well. But yeah, no. But getting back to your point, the clock is ticking. It's like the most boring Mission Impossible movie ever. Where in this one, Ethan Hunt just needs to eat all the sorbet because you know the freezer doesn't work.
Sandra and I have an operating motto for this mission we're on. Hit send. Like, whatever you find, don't care. Hit send. We're not we spent like 6 months looking for the right dishwasher. And there's a supply chain issue right now, too. So it's not like there's tons of fridges out there. So if there's something that will basically fit in the space, which will now be a big hole in the wall, hit send. You know, it's funny though, and this is what really, I don't know if you've ever had this with your parents, but do you find you get shamed by them for the weirdest things? And like my mom says to me, you know, we had our washing machine for 40 years, you know, when ours broke. And it's like, well, Mom, I guess we must be doing it wrong then. I guess we must be just like, we must be so, you know, casual about laundry that ours broke twice as fast as yours. Like, but there's like this point of pride I find amongst people who are like 70 and over that their appliances lasted way longer than ours.
Well, it's just an extension of back in our day, or, you know, it was in the good old days. It's an extension of that. But the thing is, what's the response? Like your mom says, oh, ours lasted 40 years. It's like, what do you want me to say to this? You want me to bow down to you? It's like, you know what, Mom, you're right. I should have put the dumbbells in the washing machine. Lesson learned.
Oh, empty my pockets from the bricks before I put them in.
Mm. Okay. Hold on. Let me write this down. Carry the one. All right. Shut up.
I find that 50% of the conversations with your parents after they cross that cranky threshold is you don't know what you're doing and we were always right.
Yeah.
It's funny. I find old people have a cranky threshold. My parents aren't really up against it yet, but they're getting there. After which, yeah, it's like everything you do, like my mother-in-law is there now. Like Sandra will say to me, I got to phone my mom to get yelled at.
You know what, though? It's smart. Just take it. Just go limp. Just take the yelling and move on with your day.
Yeah, that's it, right? They've earned the right.
Yeah.
They've lasted this long. They've earned the right to complain.
Yeah. I mean, not only did they birth you, but imagine trying to figure out to remember all your passwords. It's hard enough at my age. Imagine being that age and trying to work Netflix. Get the fuck out of here.
Somebody has to do a photo essay of all the different ways your parents hold the iPad when they're on FaceTime. Like, I don't know if I've ever seen my mom's whole face during an entire call. You know, I'll get the edge of the couch or the corner of her ear. What are you doing, Mom? Like, just hold it. Look at it like it's like a face in time.
Yeah, at least your mom uses an iPad. Mine does, my mom, but basically it's for crosswords. That's it. That's and puzzles. That is it. That is the only thing it is used for.
Are you playing Wordle, Matt?
Okay. Honestly, not only do I not know what Wordle is, and I don't mean this as a point of pride. I just don't care. Like, I'm busy enough, but I've had to mute the word Wordle on my Twitter account. So I no longer get everyone's colored brick patterns. I don't know what it is.
It's just a word game.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's very, very simple and very fun. It's like letters Sudoku. Like, you're just trying to find patterns until you find a word. It's fun. It's fun.
I would love it. Like that's exactly like the kind of thing I like. Yeah. But I got enough. I'm good. Well, I'm full.
Now, what are the odds that Sandra and I have both found it and are competing against each other?
Oh, not only that, you guys have probably gotten to arguments, and in the middle of it, you're going, wait a minute, what are we fighting about again?
We would never say that, man. We know exactly what we're fighting for. It's the battle for supremacy.
I still remember, I'll go under, because I don't want to hyperbolize. There was at least 15 minutes of uncomfortableness when you guys were at my cottage playing Scrabble. There was about 15 minutes of just mom and dad are fighting.
She was kicking my ass, though. Honestly, like, we were fighting just because I was being a suck. That was the first time she ever really showed me, like, she kind of let loose. Mm-hmm. And I got thrashed. I got totally, like, I was like Johnny Canine, you know, up against Earthquake.
Yep. We know how that match ends.
It wasn't good.
It was not good.
I want to play a game with you today, Matt. It's not really so much a game as much as it is, like, I just want to ask you questions. How do you feel about that?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. I was kind of in my mind mulling over what I wanted to talk about today, and I realized I can't remember the last time that I was this confused about sports. I'm usually pretty sure what I think, but both Toronto teams, like, that are, you know, I don't know how to think about them, and I think I could use your help.
I will try my best, unless it's about Siakam, because I'm just as confused as you are.
Okay, well, let's start with the Raptors, because last night's win over the Bulls was really great. Scottie Barnes was exciting. Gary Trent, they win in OT. Like, they've had some really good wins lately, and yet they are basically a 500 team. And when I find I watch them, I can't tell if they suck or they're really good. So let's just start with this. Matt, are the Raptors good?
I have an answer
for that.
I don't know if I can answer that, but I can answer why you watch them and you watch them win, but you wonder if they're good. And this has been a pet topic of mine for the last month. Go and I do this just for my show. Go and look at about the last 4 minutes of a game and look at the game log. And oftentimes the Raptors are up. And then you look up and it's tied. Like, it happened last night in the game against the Bulls. They were up by 8 with 4 minutes to go, and the game went into overtime. The problem is, the last thing you remember is the offense of the Raptors usually struggles in the most critical time of basketball, the last 4 minutes of a close game. We've seen it in wins. We've seen it in losses. And what makes us fearful is, in the playoffs, most of the game looks like the last 4 minutes of a regular season game. So it makes you nervous about the postseason.
That's a really great way of looking at it. And it explains why I don't feel good about them. Like, they seem to be able to come back from deficits, but there's a bit of score effects in there. And I think they're generally a pretty high character team.
Yeah.
And it's funny. You make a great point, Matt. And I never thought of it this way, but high character helps you to cut a deficit, but it's really talent in the NBA that keeps you from losing one.
And we saw that. And you know what, Bob, I haven't even thought about it, but the high character, I'm stealing that for next week. I was doing the morning show, so I'm done for the week for radio. But you're right. Yeah, that's a good point. The high character means you probably don't get blown out. And if you're down by a lot, the final score, you lost by 4. But, you know, like, I saw it in the game where in the last 4 minutes, the Raptors were struggling to score, while I saw, like, Vucevic with offensive rebounds and Zach LaVine getting to the basket a lot easier. On the other end, I saw Van Vliet miss a bunch of shots and turn the ball over a couple times. Shout out to Tim for making the All-Star game. But the last 4 or 5 minutes of games, you could do it in close losses to the Suns, wins to the Bulls. It is a slog a lot of the times.
I'm really loving Pascal's game lately. And what I'm especially, there's two things I love. One is the offensive rebounding, and he has high impact rebounds. They tend to influence the way he rebounds, has some effects are greater than others. And I can't tell you how this is quantified, but just knowing from following nerdy stats about basketball, he doesn't have garbage time rebounds. He tends to like really be in the thick of things with his output. And the other thing, and you've pointed this out, is the free throw line. Like, he's just better at getting to it. And it's almost always, it's like one of those great hustle stats, rebounds and free throw attempts. Like, it's almost like you wish life could be so simple as to have just a rule that's almost always true. Like, if you're a basketball player and you're getting to the line, you're probably playing well. Get to the line, kids.
Yeah. I mean, you know, unless like you're like your Steph Curry or whatever, but sure. you can go look at it. The Raptors have a losing record when Siakam has more 3-point attempts than free throws. And they have got like over a 600 winning percentage when he goes to the free throw line more than the 3-pointer. And it's one stat. It's a little simplistic, but it's an important stat.
Do you think he'll be an all-star when all of the injury substitutions are finished?
Selfishly, I hope not. I want these guys to rest. I was so happy for Van Vliet, for him as a human. Me as a Raptor fan, I wanted him to get screwed because it would have been more rest. I think there's an excellent chance Siakam will, because especially just his play the last month or so, it makes people forget the fact he wasn't around much in the first month of the year.
I'm with you on this one. I sent out a tweet a couple days ago. I expect them both to be all-stars. Fred for sure, Pascal probably. And the injury, I don't know, exception or substitution or whatever you want to call it. I kind of feel like if I'm the league, I probably have a bit of guilt how things have gone for Toronto the last couple of years. They're playing in Florida or, you know, like from the bubble to Florida to now there's no crowds. And, you know, Masai was pretty vocal about this team needs to stop being screwed by the head office. This might be a case where the league leans in and says, let's give them a second all-star. They're ninth in the league in merchandise revenue, which I found interesting, but it speaks to how there's a whole country here. And anything that makes Pascal's jersey more sellable is going to help them make lost revenue up because of all of the vaccine shutdowns of live events. So I kind of think if I'm the NBA, Pascal's made it easy for me to make a decision that I probably wanted to make anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, what you'd really want the NBA to do is to force big time free agents to come here. But that's, of course, another story. You mentioned no crowd. Three moments from last night, Bob. Van Vliet, when he's being mobbed by his teammates about being named to an all-star team. Scotty Barnes with an offensive rebound tip-in to tie it at 114 at the end of regulation. Then in overtime, Gary Trent gets the critical steal and then moments later hits the three-pointer to give the Raptors a 5-point lead. Those are three incredibly important, exciting moments. But watching them on TV without fans, it felt so blah.
I couldn't agree more. And it's like the impact of this is like so widespread because something we don't talk enough about, and I think you're 100% right, is it sucks in the arena, but it sucks on TV too. You know, like it's just a flat, and you don't really notice it until you watch another game and there is a crowd and you're like, oh shit, I remember that. Excitement. I got a quick sidebar question here.
Yep.
Has Scotty Barnes's tip in, like offensive putback, is it officially now a signature move? Like, there's little things that people do that people love. Like, remember James Van Riemsdyk had the between the legs pass that he would have? You know, like, there's just little things that players become known for. I feel like I'm ready to call the Scotty Barnes offensive putback a thing I love about Toronto sports.
I hope so. because that's a hell of a, that is a hell of a trademark move if you can do it, especially at his size. And yeah, he had that at the end of the game. And then in overtime, he was limping a bit. He still muscled past Vucevic for a you know, a good basket around, a nice impressive shot around the rim. So I hope you're right, Bob. I don't know if we're there yet, but man, I hope we get there.
I never want Gary Trent Jr. to be injured, but God, I love what he wears. And just watching him on the bench with outfits, like Gary Trent Jr.'s chest when he's wearing the cardigan with no shirt underneath.
Yeah.
I love the way that guy dresses. Okay, back to my questions for you then. Are the Raptors buyers or sellers in a month or so?
They are nothing major, but it's the obvious move. You trade Goran, who is whatever. He's the Alonzo Mourning of the Raptors now. You trade Goran and maybe a draft pick to bring back a credible bench piece. That's it. You can't really do more than that.
I don't want to, you know, with the trucker convoy, I feel like we've had enough of protest in the Canadian character, but, or at least dialogue about it. But do you feel like we've given Goran a bit of a free pass on this one?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, 100%. This is a, one of the player empowerment is both awesome, but every now and then there is unintended consequences that are less awesome. This is one of them.
How can, like, I understand things happen in professional environments. There's big money, there's big egos, all that stuff. But when you start seeing him practicing in the Heat facility or going to Heat games, like, can't someone from the league talk to him and say, hey, if you're going to take your ball and go home, at least go home. Don't go to another arena.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You know what, Bob, the analogy I'm going to give here, in like The Sopranos or in a lot of mob movies, it's understood that the main boss, he's got a gourmand. He's got something on the side. Everyone knows it. Even the wife knows it. And we're all supposed to be okay with it. But if you stop and take a step back for a second, like, wait a minute, you mean that woman that married him who birthed three of his children, she has to be fine that he's sleeping around on her? Oh, that kind of sucks. I feel bad for her. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe this is a negative situation. Maybe I shouldn't high five. It's like it with Goran. Everyone knows it. Everyone seems to be fine with it. Everyone's accepted it. But when Van Vliet and Siakam are playing 44 minutes a night, you know, no, it's not okay. Like, bleep this.
So LeBron is allowed to wear a Yankees cap when he's a Cleveland Cavalier and he's coming up to the end of his contract because he's the mob boss. He's earned that. Yeah. He's earned his side piece, as you say.
Yeah.
But Goran is like barely, he's not an underboss. He's not a, he doesn't have his own crew. I mean, basically he's Donnie Brasco. And Donnie Brasco's
Bob, he's Fredo's driver.
He's Fredo Pauly. Well, you won't see him no more. Wait, you ready for this one?
Yeah.
Wait, take the ball, leave the cannolis.
I was wondering. I knew you were going to do the cannoli line. I was wondering where you're going to go.
Yeah, I kind of botched it. But you know what, though? I'll give myself a B for effort. Hey, do you have any other Raptors chat that you want to get into? Because I have another question, but I don't want to dominate this. Is there anything like you've been feeling lately? Because now's the natural, you know, Fred's been named an all-star and with the Leafs looking at all-star break, like it just feels like this is a bit of a reset time. So is there anything else with the Raptors? You talk about them every day that you feel strongly about or don't get.
No. I mean, the big thing today is I no way do I think they're going to beat Atlanta. It's fourth game in five nights. This is scheduled loss night. I guess really just the great story is, you know, Van Vliet, there's only been four players in the modern era that were undrafted that made the all-star team. So it's a hell of a journey. And I kind of feel bad for Malachi Flynn, who might not work out, but we all view him and we're like, hey, just become like Fred. When it's like, wait a minute, it's only happened four times.
Okay, so here's my question, and I'm really going to leave this to you. A couple pods ago, I forwarded the idea that maybe you'd rather have Andrew Wiggins on your team than OG. And I think that's probably pretty dumb. I'm not saying that I agreed with it 100%, but I floated it. And how much shame do you think I deserve?
Not a ton, because the one point you made was availability. And Wiggins is always there, always playing. Now, whether it's just he's got some genetic thing in him where he just doesn't get hurt while other guys who are in great shape get hurt all the time, like an Anthony Davis. But the availability argument was the right one. Now, OG did hit 2 3-pointers. One of them was a bad possession in overtime, but whatever. They lose that game in overtime if he doesn't hit those 2 threes. I stand by OG, but I understand the Wiggins argument.
I'm no doctor or scientist, but I've read that actually with Wiggins, his longevity is because of biomechanics. I mean, part of it's always luck because you can always fall bad and get hurt. Doesn't matter. But apparently his body is perfect for basketball. You know, like when you look at a Greg Oden or this kid in Gonzaga right now, Chet Holmgren, and he's like 7 feet tall and he's like, he's got the Sean Bradley build and people are saying, is he going to go number one? It's like, why do we always have this conversation? These guys never last. They never, never, never last. Their bodies are not built for the NBA. Apparently, Andrew Wiggins is perfectly built for the NBA. So that might be it. It's not even about strength. It's about just the way his body moves, like his shot form, everything. The way he runs, the way he jumps. I thought that was really cool, actually. I wish I understood more about like kinesiology so I could appreciate it, but it's funny. I guess sometimes you see, like, you hear this all the time. It's like certain running backs have longevity, and you wonder, like, are they just lucky or are they just built for the position better, you know?
Yeah, like Frank Gore. Like Frank, maybe like a Frank Gore, just, or Curtis Martin.
Curtis Martin, some of
these guys. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. Craziness. Okay. I want to talk about movies because I have one I want to bring up to you, but you have one you wanted to bring up to me. So why don't you go first?
Oh, Bob, first off. Popcorn, movie popcorn. Went to the movies yesterday, got the popcorn, and saw Ghostbusters, the Ghostbusters Afterlife. And I will say this, fan service. Some people love it, some people hate it. I like it when it's done right. I'm the fan, service me. But don't do it where it hurts the integrity of the film. And Ghostbusters nailed it. There was plenty of fan service. There was a moment near the end. I'm not going to lie to you. It was getting dusty in the theater. But they not only perfectly honored the old movie, but they've set it up for this new young cast, diverse cast, where you're rooting for all of them. It didn't feel like, oh, they wanted to shoehorn something in to click a box or anything like that where someone on Fox News is going to get angry. Like they to me, they absolutely nailed it. Huge fan of the new Ghostbusters movie. Run, Don't Walk to go see it.
People have been hard on it. And I think
really?
I think, you know, because critics don't like fan service. And this is always
but it was well done. Roots.
Yeah, I know. But in principle, right? Like, you know how if you shoot something in black and white or if you have subtitles, critics will like it. You know, what they don't like is reboots.
Yeah.
You know. Or maybe that's less true than it used to be. But certainly this felt like it was getting picked on for one reason or another. I don't know. But fan service is interesting. You know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of J.J. Abrams, whose career is a perfect, like, it's like he's done fan service exactly right. And I think that was the first movie in the Star Trek reboot with Chris Pine.
Yep.
And done it incredibly poorly. Like the final installment, The Rise of Skywalker in the Star Wars movies. Is a piece of shit. And
we're not, let's not go there. We do it all the time, Bob. We do it all the time. But anyway.
Well, I know. But, you know, and you would disagree because you like that all the stories tied up, right? Because that's fan service.
Yes.
I thought it was hokey, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm excited. Like Ghostbusters. It's funny. I had a chance to sit with Dan Aykroyd once and just listen to him talking about the reboot, the one with Paul Feig directing with Kristen Wiig. And Melissa McCarthy. And there was a sense that maybe they'd lost the original spirit, you know, like they were making it too new. And I think that that's kind of true in a weird way. Like the chemistry of that original cast was so good. Like you kind of didn't want to see, like the new cast didn't feel the same way. And so you didn't get the same feelings. And that's what you're after is that feeling. How is Paul Rudd?
Paul Rudd's he's Paul Rudd. He's great. Every scene you enjoy him. He plays it perfectly. Like the thing is about this movie is the old characters or whatever, they're such a small part of it. Like it really is the development of the chemistry between all this new cast. Now the score was very, you know, it felt like you were back in the original Ghostbusters and there's little homages throughout. But it actually was quite a clever movie. And if it is fan service, it's fan service done right. It's like no one's going to rave about fish and chips, but fish and chips done right, you're never not going to be happy. And that's kind of what this new Ghostbusters movie was.
I kind of feel like fish and chips is underrated as best meal ever. Like, really good fish and chips, for me personally, I grew up on it. There's nothing better. Are you a tartar sauce guy?
No.
What?
Of course.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course, tartar sauce. Now, I don't want it slobbed all over the place. Give me a little coleslaw, a little tartar sauce. Get that lemon going there, and we're talking.
So what I don't understand, because they're both acidic, but I like to have lemon on the fish, but malt vinegar on the fries. Are you a malt vinegar guy?
Yes, and I agree. Malt vinegar should not be on the fish.
Because it doesn't work on the fish. Lemon is for the fish.
Yeah.
Even though they're both acids, and they're both tart, just slightly different. Are you a coleslaw guy?
Oh, yeah. No. Love the coleslaw. Actually, I probably eat coleslaw more because of fish and chips than any other thing. But, Bob, this happened to me once. You know when you're really craving a food, you got to do whatever it takes to get it?
Yes.
So I wanted fish and chips, and I went to the fish and chip place. And I'm like, oh, yes, it's fish and chip time. And they said to me, we're out of halibut and haddock, but we can make you fish and chips with salmon. And I promptly walked out of the store. I said, good day, sir, and did not come back. Trying to do it with salmon? That was nuts.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that either. And I also don't agree with scallops, getting scallops at the fish and chips place. I got no problem with scallops, but I don't want them at my fish and chips place. I don't want shrimp there.
Oh, no.
I just want fish.
Nope.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you a halibut guy?
Oh, yeah. Halibut first, haddock second.
Yeah, will you do cod?
I will, but begrudgingly. I'm pretty much just give me halibut and haddock.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. Do you have a go-to place?
Fisherman's Wharf or Cove. It's at the back of St. Lawrence Market.
You got a Buster's.
Yeah, Buster's. Thank you. Yes, Buster's. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, Buster's is good. I understand that Reliable is shutting down out in the East End, which is really
sad.
It's been there for like 50 years. Like, you know, that sucks. Merrick and I used to go and eat all the time at the Nifty Nook, which was on Annette Street over at Jane. And they actually did a Toronto Life article on it way back in the day. And it was the banner was atmosphere be damned. Like the Nifty Nook was like the least atmospheric place ever. It was like a hole in the wall with a deep fryer. And they had the best fish and chips, and they gave you tons of chips. But it was funny because it was almost famous for being so unfamous. I don't know. I don't like fancy fish and chips. Like, what's more annoying, fancy fish and chips or fancy hamburger?
Oh, great question. I think I'm going to go with fancy fish and chips. Because the hamburger, at the very least, different meats are good. And if you get a chef who knows how to cook it a little bit rare, I'm going to be a fan of it. But to me, fish and chips, it's a very simple thing. I don't need you to deviate at all from it.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you there too. I was in Los Angeles once and I went to the Beverly Hills Hotel, Palm Springs Hotel. What was it? No, Beverly Hills. Yeah, Beverly Hills Hotel. And I had a $30 hamburger. It was good, but it's kind of like expensive jeans. Some things are never supposed to be expensive. And I think hamburger and fish and chips are that. Jeans are that. What else should never be expensive?
Oh, this is a great question. Chocolate bars. I got to do something different than that. Chicken wings.
Yes, chicken wings. Nachos should never be expensive. So maybe just bar food.
Yeah.
Generally speaking.
Really? Yeah, bar food never needs to be. And it sometimes it feels like, okay, you're gilding the lily. You're getting a little too proud of yourself with a $30 hamburger. Okay, stop patting yourself on the back. I don't need it. A $30 steak, fine. $30 lamb, I'm here for all the time. But if it's if it can be served in a place that has 12 TVs and all of them have a different sporting event, you don't need to go expensive.
Or back in the day, those 12 TVs would be showing some out of market hockey game instead of the Raptors game back in the day.
Oh my God. Oh yeah. That is true, by the way. If you're under 25 or so, you don't remember it, but I remember getting the stink eye going, can the Raptor game be on one of the channels? And it was a Saturday night, and it was the Leafs and Montreal. But I'm like, can I have one TV with a Raptor game? Just one. I'm begging you.
Jeff Pollock, before we get to the Leafs and the Olympics.
Yes, by the way, Jeff. Yeah. Jeff Pollock, let me tell you something. He is both comforting and not crazy expensive as well, but you get what you pay for and you get quality. Our lawyer is Jeff Pollock. If you need a lawyer, it's jeffpollock.com. Jeff with a G, jeffpollock.com. It is a small, fancy boutique lawyer house. I don't think they call it a lawyer house, but you're going to get the service of a friendly neighborhood diner. So it is a, if you need legal help, if there's ever a point in your life you realize, oh, wait a minute, I need a lawyer for a will or for whatever, jeffpollock.com is where to go. I guess you just call it a law firm, not a lawyer house. I'm a dummy.
I like lawyer house, though. It's like, what do they call pubs? Publican houses? Is that what they're called? Isn't that what pub's short for? Publican something or other? Anyway.
I don't know.
I reached out to Jeff this week, actually. Oh. There's chaos in the Conservative Party. I want to see how he was doing. You know, I'm not necessarily, I think that I've made it abundantly clear, a lot of my policies are divergent from the Conservative path. But I do have respect for anybody who is sincere in their public service. And I think probably is trying to pull the margins towards the middle, I think is a good thing to do right now. So I think that's what Aaron O'Toole was tasked with doing. It obviously didn't go so great. But yeah, I just checked in, you know, like I will say this. I don't feel like I ever want to have to vote Conservative, but I want there to be a strong center-right party to make sure that dialogue stays healthy in our country.
You've always said that. Like you have the most healthiest outlook when politically, because you're very passionate. You know, you wear your emotion on your sleeve. You are who you are, but you respect the idea. You respect the other side in the sense of if you have a strong other side, it makes the side you vote for even better and more accountable. And really, in the end, that's kind of what you want, is the highest level of accountability. So, no, you're 100% right.
Yeah, and then the problem with these sort of echo chambers is that you never have to prove anything. When you meet people who don't agree with you, who are smart, and you generally think they're essentially decent people who also want to do the right thing, you're forced to explain yourself. And, you know, Strobo and I talk about this all the time. People ask how come he's a really good interviewer. It's not the first. Well, you know this. You do interviews. The most powerful question is not the first one you ask. It's the second one when you ask, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Or why do you think that? You know, the second you ask somebody to explain themselves, like you find out, like things unravel sometimes. Things that you think you understood, maybe you don't understand as well as you'd expect, you know, and you never get to do that in the echo chamber because everybody is just agreeing with each other. How the hell is anything supposed to get better?
It's a safe space that often satiates because y'all agree and then you move on with your day. By the way, Bob, I love the fact that when Jeff and I are chatting, it's about, you know, some Northern Rhone Syrah he's pairing with his dinner. And for you, it's about almost things as important, politics and the future of our country.
You know, I will say this about the Conservatives. Like, I don't necessarily agree with the answers, but I don't think you can also, like, what is a reasonable, like, we're in the middle of a pandemic, so what's the best way to act? Like, I don't think we should be afraid to ask those questions. You know what I mean? Yeah. Your answers may differ from mine. I may even get to the point where I think your answers are terrible. But regardless, like we should all be asking what's the right way to go forward. And we should be critical of the other side and ourselves all the time, you know? So anyway, I just reached out to Jeff and I thought it was worth mentioning because, you know, I think this might be a little bit of out of the frying pan and into the fire when it comes to discourse, you know? We may miss this gang in 10 years, you know?
Yeah.
I got a movie I want to throw out to you before we get to the, Leafs. You know what movie I finally saw because it's up on Disney streaming now. I finally saw Eternals.
Oh, okay. I've been looking at it. I'm like, I'm waiting for when Amy is flying and cause she doesn't have an interest in it. And, how is it, Bob? Tell me.
Okay. So here is my 6 months after the fact review of Eternals. It's actually pretty good, but there's too much there. It's very set up. Like there's tons of setup and a lot of discussions, you know, but it's actually okay. You know, like I would say there are other Marvel movies that suck way worse than this. I think it's hard and it really goes to show if you don't know the characters and you're not invested in them, then they start to look like grownups in suits. You know, like when it's Spider-Man or Iron Man and you grew up, you know, it's not weird to see Tony Stark, but
yeah,
you know, they do seem a little bit like grownups trying to do Shakespeare in long johns. But what I thought was really interesting about it was, one, it makes Jack Kirby out to be the genius that he is. I mean, he really is one of the, you know, he's the creator of a lot of these characters and, you know, he's a super genius. But it really talks about narrative. You know what I mean? Like when people decide they're not going to like something, they don't like it. And when people want to make excuses for something, it can be mediocre and praised like it's the best thing ever. And I kind of feel like for whatever reason, people decided they weren't that interested in Eternals. And then they weren't. But you know what movie strikes me defeated this? It's the only movie in recent memory where I think people thought this isn't going to be that good. And then it turned out to be great.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
My Cousin Vinny. I had no expectations. It was great.
Okay, that's a good one. In fact, this is a good topic, actually. This would be a good top five movies you thought wouldn't be good, but were. I was going to say Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay, yeah.
I thought it was going to be hokey, and it turned out it was charming. Mm-hmm. By the way, that was George texting me. I got to go pick up his guitar because my daughter wants to learn electric guitar. Her form of teenage rebellion now is, I want to learn electric guitar, Dad.
That's perfect, though. Let me tell you, teenage rebellion of I want to learn an instrument is far better than teenage rebellion. I'm going to get that pierced with that, you know.
She said to me the other day, did you know, Dad, that Satanism is not actually the worship of Satan, but it's they advocate for free will. I'm like,
I'd be like, pick up a guitar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway. So, yeah, I actually thought it was okay, but what really jumped out at me was it was better than I think a lot of people made it out to be. And how often it is that we decide how good movies are going to be or not before they come out.
It happens all the time.
It really does. I stopped reading reviews a lot of years ago because I just don't want, and I try not to give them. People should make up their own minds, you know?
Well, I'll definitely check it out. I feel a little bit better with your review. And definitely can see Ghostbusters.
Oh, for sure. I'm just waiting for all this stuff to come out on streaming because we're not going to the theater right now. Okay. Leafers. Yeah. Here's my question for you. You ready?
Yeah.
Going back to the beginning of the season and what you were expecting to happen, what were you right about and what were you wrong about?
I was right about, you know, that Matthews would continue. I was right. I thought Jack Campbell was going to be good. I thought Jack Campbell, I was more favorable about him than you were. And by the way, you're not alone. I think the majority of people were more nervous than not. What I was wrong about was Mrazek. I was wrong about Justin Hall. I would say those were Hall and Mrazek were the main things I was wrong about. Campbell and Matthews, definitely right about.
I was wrong about a bunch. I was wrong about Campbell. I can't even say I was necessarily wrong. I was suspicious. I didn't think he would do bad. I just didn't want to commit to he'll do good. Now, you were right. You thought he'd be good. I was more like, I'll wait and see, but let's not assume he's going to be good. So in that sense, I wasn't right, but I wasn't wrong. I was wrong about Marner. I thought that his productivity was going to drop off. And with, you know, his shitty couple months behind him, he looks pretty great. And I feel more and more confident that he's going to do well in the upcoming playoffs, you know? So I think I was wrong. I never expected him to be bad. I expected him to be good, but he might be great. So we'll see. I think I was right about Muzzin. I was thinking back to the first couple games and the first pod we did after the first couple games. And I said, does he look a little slow to you out there? You know, and I sent a note to Jonas and I was like, does he look slow out there? And we kind of got into a text thread about, you know, he's a smart guy. He knows how to play, you know, really well positionally, thinks the game very well. But it seems like, you know, you get these weird, you know, you get 2-3 game samples and maybe they don't mean anything. Like Tavares is terrible for this. He looks really great. People are super excited. He looks shit for 5 games. You're like, oh, he's old and slow. And the truth is he'll probably be around a point a game like he always is. But this Muzzin thing, I feel like I was right about that. And going into this back half of the year and gearing up for the playoffs, I know we've talked about this before, but I can't help but think this has got to have that brain trust in knots. What the hell to do about that defense?
And it's all about Muzzin. We talked about it last week. Jacob, all about whatever. It's all about Muzzin. By the way, when someone says, oh, no, don't worry, he's great in terms of positioning, that means you're slow. You know, like when someone says, oh, no, they know how to positionally be in the right place. They know how to read the angles. That's code for you're not that fast.
Well, and, you know, we saw this with Ron Hainsey, who actually was a pretty competent defenseman. It's just they wanted him to play first line minutes, like first pairing minutes. And that wasn't what he was well suited for. But he wasn't super fast. I think he just, you know, and I wonder if this happens. This must happen in football all the time, where you know you're slowing down, so you learn to maximize what you have to offer. You know, like you play, I guess the cliche is you play within yourself. And one of the things that's hard when you're playing those really hard minutes is you don't have the luxury of doing that anymore because you're just facing too much skill all the time. And there was one more thing I was right about, and I kind of want to get more into this. I was right that William Nylander was going to have a great year. I thought he was not going to have a good year. I thought he was going to have a great year. Is he past being a pleasant surprise, or can we still say the year he's having is a pleasant surprise?
I think it's beyond that. Of course, it's been a while since he scored a goal. But no, he's no longer. I think he's past the point of pleasant surprise, which is a compliment. I think it's now becoming normal to see him on the penalty kill. It's now normal to see him playing close to 20 minutes a night. And I think that's the main thing.
Were we right or wrong about Sheldon Keefe being a good leader for this team? I'm not saying good coach. I'm saying good leader for this team. What's your confidence in Sheldon Keefe once we get to the playoffs, his ability to provide whatever invisible X factor that coaches do?
I feel good about him, but like I never felt when they lost last year, oh, that was the coach. I've never really felt during any time he got here, I'm like, oh, wow, he's been really outcoached by whoever the opposing coach is. I've never felt that. And by the way, they haven't lost since he called the team soft and purposeless.
Right. No, it's true. So I agree with you, but I'm going to get back to this a different way. Do you think that Sheldon Keefe is Toronto's secret curmudgeon?
Yes, 100%. And it's because he came off Mike Babcock. So if you're the next coach after Babcock, then you must be, oh, you must be the friendly player coach because Babcock's done and hockey works. You get tough disciplinarian. Then you get Mark Harmon from summer school. And then you get the principal from summer school. You know, it goes like that. But no, Sheldon Keefe is, he knows his way around a swear word.
I think this is a great observation, and not enough has been made that the cliche, to your point, is you go from the disciplinarian, from Mr. Hand, to Mark Harmon from summer school.
Yeah, exactly.
You're absolutely right. By the way, do you know Ben Ziegelstein, who we used to work with, used to call me Chainsaw? If anyone's seen summer school, he used to call me Chainsaw because I was always so sloppy looking, to be perfectly frank.
Yes.
Yeah. But you're right, though, because there's this idea that he must be a player's guy because he replaced the guy who wasn't.
Yeah.
But I think he's a prickly son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to say that he can't be loving or compassionate or caring or that his players don't like him, but I just got this feeling like we've never really gotten to know him. Plus, like so much of the, you know, it's been such a weird time to get to know a coach like him because, you know, there was the bubble and then the limited media access and it's all Zoom and, you know, it's been all so messed up. Like, we haven't really spent any time with this guy. I think now we're just starting to realize what he is, which is he's a bit of a boot camp guy.
He is. And also, another point, because he was Dubas's guy, we assumed he's going to be soft and progressive and, hey, don't worry about it, guys. You know, I'm here to listen to you and empower you. And I'm not your boss. We're partners. When it's like, nah, that might not be necessarily true.
You're 100% right. That's such a great observation that because Dubas picked him, it's like, oh, well, he must be kumbaya then.
Yeah.
And like somewhere between kumbaya and kind of like, you know, Martin Prince from The Simpsons.
What is it, roundies?
I saw this thing on online where it was a picture of Martin all happy and Nelson Muntz walking next to him all mad.
Yeah.
And it just said every podcast duo ever.
Oh, that's true. He's angry. He's wacky, you know. That's so, like us, Bob. I'm the angry one. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. Oh, my daughter plays guitar. Why don't you and George Strabopoulos, why don't you go and beat it, you bunch of no good Knicks?
I had to look at it and I laughed. There was happy Martin Prince dancing and Nelson was looking to punch someone. I honestly thought, well, that's every week we do that for about 50 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
We don't have a ton of time left, and I want to talk to you about the Olympics. First of all, I'm curious. Like, I've been in sports radio when the Olympics have been on in the past, and it's always weird because there's embargoes. What you can and can't say, is that still true?
Oh, Bob. Okay, I'm going to paraphrase the intro if we ever do live coverage. Thank you, CBC. Oh, CBC, we love you so much. For only you and the IOC and whomever your sponsors are can shine your golden light unto us. We do not deserve you. And now we take you live to Luge. Like, there's all these rules. There are so many rules with Olympic coverage.
I got to tell you, even when I was at CBC during the 2010 Olympics, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. They have rules too.
They do as well, the IOC. Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, people talk about tyranny. You know what? You don't have to look that far for it. The IOC's got a pretty iron grip on its product.
Oh, my God. More so than anything else. I remember at Sun TV, all we could do is I would do crudely drawn sketches of people on moguls. And that would be our highlights from the Olympics.
I guess they pay a lot of money and they're pretty careful about protecting those relationships. But, man, it doesn't even feel like news. It feels like, I don't know, like you're talking about the Caramilk secret or something.
Oh, even more than that. I feel, Bob, if I tweeted out, if I videotaped an Olympic event from my phone and then I tweeted it out, within 5 minutes, there would be a knock on the door and it would be Jaws from James Bond coming to bite me.
I made a few Simpsons references today, but it's like when Bill Gates buys out Homer's company. All right, boys, buy him out.
Yeah. They just start kicking the shit out of
everything. Start smashing his computers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it doesn't, like, I'll put it this way, Bob. I was doing the morning show today, and, you know, we had to do this Olympic thing, and I, you know, the script, and I do get it. The IOC pays a ton of money. I get it. It was the only time in the show today I was nervous. Yeah, I was like, okay, say it right, say it correctly, because they're always watching. They're always watching.
It's so true. It's like you assume that they have some kind of voice recognition software, and if anyone says Olympics, like somewhere a bell goes off and an assistant starts taping what you're saying.
And there's sometimes, I don't even think you're allowed to use the word Olympic. I'm not even joking.
I know. People may think we're joking, but honestly, sit down and talk to anybody who's covered in Olympics. Like, you get, it's like Mike Martz's playbook, but for rules. Like, it's about 41 pages long, and here's what you can't say.
Ooh, wait, Bob. Okay, I'm going to give you two options. Which one feels more like IOC rules with highlights? Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
One, the new Glengarry leads. Or two, these are the new leads. Or two, I'm not going to do the whole speech.
Okay.
Or two, whatever's in the briefcase in Pulp Fiction.
Ooh, whatever's in the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Yeah, I love that. They glow. People don't know this, but when they give you the binder, what you can say about the Olympics, the file glows.
It does. It's a true story. True fact.
You know, this is, the Olympics is always hard for me because year after year, it's become less and less easy to root for it as an institution. But
yeah,
all of our time at Off the Record, we spent so much time with amateur athletes, Olympians who would come in, you know, summer and winter games. And we got to know them pretty well, a bunch of them, some of the country's best athletes. And, you know, like, they're not rich. They're incredibly good at what they do, like globally incredible at what they do. But a lot of them really just did it because they loved sports and this was the sport they loved. And so the sacrifices, the dedication, the talent, all of that stuff, like, if you're going to let yourself be duped, I'd almost allow myself to be duped for them because at least they deserve an audience.
Perfect way to put it, Bob. As Bruce Arthur said, in the end, the athletes always win. The athletes always make the Olympics compelling. And when we talk about pressure for an athlete in any sport, if Matt Stafford throws four interceptions in the Super Bowl, well, he's got next year. If you are a downhill skier, you've trained 4 years for this moment, and within 3 seconds you catch one edge, well, that's it. Thanks for coming out. Maybe we'll see you in 4 years unless you're too old. There's the pressure on the Olympians far more than anything else.
And the world championships, which happen much more frequently, people don't follow them unless you're really a fan of a sport. And a lot of these sports, like, who's so into, you know, cross-country skiing that they need to follow the world championships? You know, like, it's always about stakes. It's like storytelling. Sports is like any story. It's all about the stakes you set up. And, you know, the scarcity that you talk about, Matt, is what creates great stakes around this. This is people spend their entire lives training for a 4-minute race. Incredible. And, you know, one of the things, like, I'm sure there's plenty of Olympians who are assholes, but one thing I found generally is you tend to get more spirituality out of the amateur athletes than you do the pros. The pros know what they're in it for. You know, they almost feel like hedge fund managers, you know, like they know what they have to do, what everything's worth. But with the amateur athletics, especially on some of the more fringe sports, like I'm thinking about Simon Whitfield in triathlon, like you really meet some interesting people who are, I don't know, I guess just for lack of a better word, there's kind of that point where athletics intersects with spirituality, which I don't think we get enough. Like we get it as a commodity so often that you forget, like there's something beautiful about being really fit.
Yes. Oh, no, Bob, you're right. And I should remember our most famous ice dancers, Tessa, or God, now I can't. All right, they were going to end this podcast on a real low note. The most famous, and they won gold in the last Olympics, and it was going to be taken away from them. Then it ended up being a tie. And she's dating Morgan Riley.
Yeah, what's her name? Tessa Virtue.
Tessa Virtue. I was thinking Tessa Bonham. Anyway, God, I'm an idiot. Yes, Tessa Virtue. You know, she could be one that you could consider, okay, she's a little more famous and sponsors, so maybe she's not as down-to-earth and friendly. Not only couldn't have been nicer, she showed up 3 minutes late for a radio interview in person, and she spent the first 45 seconds apologizing. And not apologizing because her PR person told her to, but because she's just a nice person.
I don't think we champion them as a couple enough, because Morgan Riley's pretty damn impressive, too, as a young man. I kind of feel like they're like our sports Harry and Meghan, but maybe less about the money.
They're like Harry and Meghan, but actually genuine human people that you can root for.
Yeah. In fact, you know what? Like, we kind of had this with James and April Reimer once upon a time, where there was like this couple that everybody liked, and they were super sweet. They had this kind of like Mayberry vibe about them. Yeah, that's it. Morgan Riley and Tessa Virtue, Toronto's number one sports couple.
It's certainly better than you and I, Bob, with me dancing around everywhere and you ready to punch someone their chainsaw.
In my cutoff vest, sleeveless vest.
Exactly.
Well, Matt, I'd like to stick around, but I've got some people I got to go yell at.
All right. You go yell at them, Bob. We will chat next week. Good luck with your daughter and the guitar. And all the best, Bob. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.